Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Teen Movie Cheerleaders. Wait, there are guys that go to this school who don't play football? And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. With me is James.
Really?
For those who... Look, James, it's not a visual medium. They can't see the weird, creepy glare that you just gave me.
Hi, guys. I'm here. He wasn't lying.
Let's continue. What's our topic, Jim? Do you have an intro for this, or are you just going to look at me weird?
No, I don't. I was going to do, like, a little Bender speech about receiving a John Hughes box set for Christmas.
Okay.
But, no. We're going to talk about John Hughes movies.
Yes.
Specifically, his 80s... earliest movies.
Teen movies. Like, this is kind of a Brat Pack podcast, I think you could say.
Kinda.
But, you know. Yeah. It's weird. It's not a No Tour podcast. Like, we're not watching all of John Hughes' movies because we wouldn't want to watch Curly Sue.
Mr. Mom.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I just wrote that. But, yeah. No. Whatever. 80s teen film. That's what we're talking about.
We're talking about 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
And I watched a few other ones, just in case,
and advise me against.
Yeah, yeah. In case we need to, talk about Saint Elmo's Fire, Some Kind of Wonderful, or Say Anything, I'm prepared.
But yeah, he really did kind of dominate the teen genre in the '80s. Kind of pioneered the '80s teen genre. John Hughes wrote and directed most of the movies we discussed.
Yeah,
yeah. We'll kind of get to each one, but just. To start off with John Hughes altogether, he started off just writing one-line jokes for comedians like Rodney Dangerfield and stuff. Eventually kind of parlayed that into a little advertising gig, but kept on writing, stayed interested in comedy and movies and stuff. He wrote a short story called Vacation 58 based on one of the family vacations he took as a child, which turned into National Lampoon's Vacation.
Yeah, he wrote that for the National Lampoon scene, right?
Yeah. And then they turned that into a movie, so he did the screenplay for that as well. And kind of from there, that was his launching pad, really.
Yeah.
Just a few years after that, he did. He got his first chance to direct with 16 Candles.
Yes, he did.
So I guess that seems like a good place to start.
Yes. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, so he kind of established himself as a writer at this point, and so they were going to give him a chance to write and direct a movie on his own. He asked for some headshots of young teenage actresses. I guess he came along Molly Ringwald's and just kind of got really, you know, stunned by it. Mm-hmm. Picked it up, posted it above his desk, and then wrote all of 16 Candles over the course of a weekend with her in mind.
Yeah, yeah. She didn't even have to audition, which is insane, given that I don't know what she did beforehand.
Yeah. But, well, I guess she was an actress. Had never done anything big. She'd done mostly stage plays and stuff.
Oh, like yeah, that. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, and the 16 Candles is sort of the story of Samantha Baker. That's her name, right?
Yes.
Who is played by Molly Ringwald. And it's her 16th birthday, and she wakes up, and her family has forgotten about her, essentially. Forgotten it's her birthday. Her sister's getting married the next day. So, I mean, they have a reason, I guess. But it's still sort of like, they forgot about me. I can't believe they forgot my fucking birthday.
And it's your 16th birthday.
Yeah.
Which means a
lot. Pop culture tells us that's important.
Yeah. And Samantha seems to think so.
Yeah.
So she's pretty hurt.
Yeah.
Goes to school, kind of tells her friend that, you know, it's not a great day. They've already forgot her birthday. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then she comes home.
Yeah, I mean it's not a movie that's filled with things that happen. You know,
like, yeah. Well,
it's the day at school, and then the dance, and then the wedding.
The day at school. One kind of important point is the sex quiz they have to fill out.
Yes,
which it appears they don't even have photocopiers for.
It's not a quiz that they have to fill out. That's something that she's handing. Like, it's a note passing thing between her friend. Like, her friend passed her those questions.
Oh, okay.
That's my interpretation.
No, I think they show other people filling it out too, though.
That seems very odd, because it's like,
I agree.
If you could do it, who would you do it with? That's not in the curriculum. I know there was a lot of blow.
It's a crazy time.
I know there was a lot of blow in the 80s, but there wasn't that much blow, especially not in the school system.
Big change. Well, anyway, you're absolutely right. She does fill out this kind of sex quiz thing, tries to hand it to her friend, drops it, Jake Ryan, the sexy senior,
yeah,
sexy 28-year-old senior.
Yeah. He's got such a good name, though. His name is perfect for this.
For that character, yeah. So in her little sex quiz there, she states that she's a virgin. She's saving herself for Jake. Jake reads this and gets pretty interested in her.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of more, intrigued about her
mysteriousness.
Yes. Doesn't know anything
about
it. Can't
be interested. He has to be intrigued.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a recurring thing.
Normal people get interested. Cool people get intrigued.
Jake Ryan gets intrigued.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's more stuff goes on at school. Samantha goes home to find what at her house?
That is a good question. I do not remember.
Her grandparents.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Her grandparents are there for the wedding.
Yeah, the wedding the next day.
They're in her room.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So her room's been taken over. Her day just went from bad to worse with the sex quiz to the worst when her room's taken over by her grandparents. Yeah, so. And then she kind of gets felt up by one of them really quickly.
Which is so weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's quick, but it's not.
It's like, oh, your boobies came in. And then she grabs the boobs.
Hack, hack.
That was so bizarre. And I had seen that movie before, and I don't know how I forgot that, because that is super weird.
Makes me miss my grandparents. Anyway, it's not only her grandparents, but another guest is staying in the house.
Yeah, Long Duck Dong.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was
one of the most offensive characters I have ever seen put to film.
Well, I was reading about this, and
this is like Mickey Rooney and Breakfast at Tiffany's type stuff. It's awful.
Yeah, and I'm pretty certain it was Roger Ebert's review, but he addresses this character and says that this very easily could have just been an Asian stereotype character, but this actor, Getty Watanabe, escalates it to high art.
Yeah.
And no. This is one of the things you're wrong on there, Ebert. Yeah. Things aren't great there.
No. But, whatever. It was the early 80s. This is sort of... Things like that still happened.
Yeah, and I'm certainly not one to...
And these are, these aren't big, are there any other notable Asian characters in any of the movies? The most notable character is African-American character in any of the John Hughes-directed movies is, the one of the people who, one of the valets for the cars in the parking garage.
Yeah.
And who ends up going on a joyride in the car.
Yeah. I'm certainly not one who always cries out for more political correctness in things, mm-hmm. but... Yeah, as you said, the early 80s, there's a couple of derogatory terms for homosexuals that get thrown around lightly.
Well,
and this Asian thing.
These are very much movies of the times. And, John Hughes has said he wasn't in an interview. I'm not going to pretend to know that I know the black experience. That's a quote. And, you can sort of apply that to any sort of minority. But...
A little insensitive.
That it was insensitive, but you know.
It's a different time. It's tough to criticize that.
And it was different time with the homophobia as well. And it really proves how much things have changed in that it's really jarring when people are using the F-A bomb in 16 Candles especially. But it shows up in everything but Ferris Bueller, I think. We're going to talk about
it. I think so.
Yeah.
The other... character we really haven't mentioned for 16 Candles, who is an important part, would be the geek.
Yes.
Anthony Michael Hall.
Yes. Who you love.
Who I just learned that I loved over the past, week.
Yeah, he's awesome,
I had no idea.
Yeah. You know why you like him?
Why?
He's Topher Grace.
Is he?
He's Topher Grace. Everything Topher Grace does is Anthony Michael Hall.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And, especially, the way he dances, he comes up to Samantha at the dance and just starts dancing. I could see Topher Grace doing those exact moves.
Yeah, okay, I believe that for sure. Yeah.
And Topher Grace actually just produced a movie that was sort of, it's a teen movie taking place in the 80s, and or kind of a teen movie taking place in the 80s, and it's always, it's clear that it's very much a tribute to sort of, Hughes movies and stuff like that. It's called Take Me Home Tonight.
Yeah.
It was kind of decent, and, I think if you asked Topher Grace, who one of his favorite actors was in the 80s, he'd say Anthony Michael Hall, no question.
Me too. How geeky is the geek?
Pretty geeky, I don't know.
Yeah, in this one he is, but he's not the, John Hughes talks about the interviewing process and casting him and Anthony Michael Hall's audition, and the character is called the geek. Sometimes he's called Ted or Farmer Ted for some reason, I don't know. But he's not really the stereotypical geek. It's not the thick glasses, the ballpoint pens and a pocket protector and a calculator. he and John Cusack do love discussing floppy disks.
Yes.
And,
it's you just know. Floppy disks are really expensive.
That's an awesome line, retrospectively. Because once again, they are expensive now because
yeah, that's true.
They'd be museums. Mm. Yeah, but the geek is bragging throughout this whole movie that he's going to get some Samantha.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have that one scene in the auto shop where they sit in the half deconstructed car and talk to each other.
Yep.
I really like that scene.
Yeah, it's a good scene.
Yeah. And he kind of opens up. He has more confidence than most nerds, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, he is an overly confident person, but I think the general idea of him is that not all nerdy people are totally quiet all the time and, like, totally lack any sort of social skills. He's overly confident, and that sort of leads to all the awkwardness that comes out of him. But, like, I don't know. I feel like that's far more realistic than, like, the pocket protector nerd. I know more people like Anthony Michael Hall, or I knew more people like Anthony Michael Hall in high school than I did people like, I don't know, the type of nerd you're talking about.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So, yeah, he is more confident than the average nerdy type of person. But, I mean, I was of a similar type of, you know, I'm not the most, I don't know, non-geeky person. But
yeah.
I'm also not so geeky that I can't have a conversation or that I don't, you know, say, hey, let's start this conversation.
Yeah, well, and I mean, it's, I guess, one thing John Hughes liked about that is that, as you said, there are more of these actual kinds of geeks or nerds in the world, whereas it's a lot easier to have a very stereotypical nerd because that gives you that kind of cinematic shorthand very quickly. You're like, okay, glasses, nerd, done. Like, that's it. It's, we don't even really need to build a character, but I guess he really appreciated that he was, you know, playing it straight and trying to make a more realistic character out of the geek.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, it's not hard to tell that Anthony Michael Hall is a pretty talented guy, and
yeah,
it shows in the movie.
So in the car there, that discussion they have in the auto shop inside the school there, Samantha and the geek kind of open up to each other a little bit. He admits that he's a virgin, which yeah. is not much of an admission.
I was shocked.
Samantha.
It's like Sixth Sense and then finding that out in 16 Cannibals.
And then she does him the favor of lending him her panties.
Which is an extremely nice thing to do.
That's a very sweet thing to do. It's like the nicest thing I think she ever does.
Yeah.
And then he goes back and shows his friends, who then have a little, like, dollar peep show in the bathroom to come see them.
Which is funny.
Very funny. And then we get the common teen year-ending party scene.
Yeah, the house party.
Yeah. You like that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good place to make everything happen.
You know? Tie everything up. It's very, a couple things in this movie, but the house party, especially how it ends, it's very, can't hardly wait.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, we have, you know, the geek being the overly confident loser, who is the Seth Green character. And at the end, we have, actually, I guess he's kind of both the main character in
Can't
Hardly Wait and Seth Green, too. Yeah. And at the end of the party, after the house has been Jake Ryan's house has been trashed, Jake Ryan finds the geek kind of hiding under the table.
Yes.
And they bond, and it's a lot. I found it just reminded me a lot of the end of
No, there are certainly similarities. I mean, it's not like, you know, Gus Van Sant's Psycho or anything.
No.
There are definite similarities.
Right on. And then there's the wedding scene at the end.
Yeah, there's a wedding scene. And
we missed anything?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Carl, the janitor, who we will soon see again, is the groom. Brian Doyle Murray marries them, which is awesome. Yeah, it's a wedding.
Yeah, well, Samantha comes out, and she went there by herself, and Jake's there.
Yes, Jake is there with his car.
Yep.
And his last name, Ryan.
Jake having learned something from his house party that his girlfriend kind of contributed to the trashing of his parents' home.
Yeah.
They break up, and then in a weird moment, Jake kind of barters her drunken,
which is extremely weird,
sexualness to the geek in exchange for,
I don't know,
yeah,
beer.
It's an exchange for the help with Samantha.
Yeah, that's true.
That's kind of what the trade-off is. It's like, I'm going to give you this nice emotional advice about this sweet girl, and in exchange, you will let me F your drunk slut of an ex-girlfriend in your car.
Yeah, I don't think he goes through with it. I can't imagine he does.
No, I don't think. But they do seem to be getting along by the end. Like, she seems interested in him by the morning. So this movie did well. I mean, it was received pretty well.
Okay, I just want to talk about one other quick thing.
Go for it.
How good is Joan Cusack in this movie? She is awesome.
Really?
Yeah, she's hilarious.
I don't know if... Like, I think other people could have done it.
But she's still funny.
Yeah,
she still
funny.
Does it.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you not think other people could have done the Anthony Michael Hall role or the Molly Ringwald role?
But I don't know as well. Okay. For Anthony Michael Hall, okay. I bet a bunch of people could do Molly Ringwald.
Yeah. I just thought Joan Cusack was hilarious. She's one of my favorite parts of this movie for sure.
Yeah, she's funny.
So, anyways. Okay. You were saying.
Well, I was saying people liked this movie when it came out. It wasn't a huge hit, but it really kind of added to the momentum that John Hughes had at the time. It was only cost about $6.5 million to make and made about $24 million. So pretty good return on investment.
Yeah.
But really, for Anthony Michael Hall and Molly Ringwald, this was huge. This really put them into the, star status.
Yeah, well, it was, it made them noticeable. I don't think they were at star status till Breakfast Club.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, I wasn't alive. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's sort of, actors tend to have, this role where they're like, oh, okay, you're on the look for them, look at it, and then there's this one. It's okay, now you're here.
And that's what 16 Candles was for the both of them, you think?
Yeah, and then Breakfast Club sort of, kicked the door down.
Cool. We talked about this one a little bit before, and you had mentioned something about this movie kind of changing the tides a bit of teenagers no longer being the outcasts in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's sort of like the movie 16 Candles is sort of, it's very much wish fulfillment. This and Pretty in Pink specifically are kind of like fairy tale movies. But 16 Candles is like the outcast of Hollywood. Cameron Crowe has said when they were writing Fast Times at Ridgemont High, he wrote the screenplay for that. It was directed by Amy Heckling. He said that studio heads would say things like, teens don't want to see movies about themselves, and the only way you can make a teen movie is by making it nostalgic, like American Graffiti, so the adults are like, oh, I remember when I was a teen, and so Fast Times at Ridgemont High is very important in the teen movie, in that it was that kind of movie, and that it was how teens saw themselves, and that it was a hit sort of. What?
Oh, just teens hate teenagers. Oh, they hate. Just the faulty logic.
Each other?
Are they not the most self-obsessed age group? But anyway,
yeah. How much of that has to do with Hughes movies, though, is the question.
Yeah,
and so Fast Times at Ridgemont High was a hit, and or at least a moderate hit, and that sort of told studios, oh, okay, we can give this Hughes guy a shot with his teen movies, and then, now they're these movies, these big, iconic movies. And yeah, the movie is essentially about outcasts, like Samantha and the geek specifically, and they're sort of the neglected audience that the movie is made for. The movie is made for people like Samantha and the geek, who had been totally neglected by these people like Jake Ryan or the blonde, whatever the blonde girl's name was. I forget her name.
Boobs.
Great. They've been neglected by the studios and, movies in general, this glamorous ideal of Hollywood. They've just been neglected by it. And it's sort of 16 Candles is them sort of being accepted by these characters, like the geek and Samantha are accepted by these characters. And Hollywood has sort of accepted now and that it was a hit, because enough of these people showed up in the theater.
Right on. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Mm. And now, as we know, teens are such a valuable demographic. They have so much disposable income, and people marketing TVs and shows really want that youthful demographic.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Anything else to say about 16 Candles?
When the grandparents show up, the Jaws music plays. I find that funny. There's a real terror of old people in these movies.
Yeah. And I think we'll get to that later. Where does, of the kind of the four movies that we're focusing on a lot today, where does this one fall in with you?
I don't know. I can everything but Ferris Bueller. Ferris Bueller's clearly number one for me. Everything else is totally interchangeable to me.
Really?
Yeah. In every one of these. I'm more interested in every one of these movies than I am
a fan of.
Yeah. I think it is the least interesting movie. I think it is it's the funniest of the three that aren't Ferris. But I mean,
yeah. I thought it was really funny.
Yeah. No, it is funny. It's a funny movie. But it's just kind of a comedy. I don't see much in it. Other than that.
Yeah, that's fine. I really wasn't expecting it to be as funny as it was. And I think that's maybe why I seem to remember it being really funny, but just kind of, I knew it was about a girl whose birthday was forgotten. And I knew it was, this was the first of the John Hughes movies other than Ferris Bueller's, which I saw a lot when I was young. This is the first of those first three that we're going to talk about. It was the first one I had seen. So I knew John Hughes just kind of distantly as someone who makes these kind of melodramatic, heavier movies. Mm-hmm. And I guess that was more the influence of the Breakfast Club on his reputation. I just thought this was going to be a bit heavier and darker. I just had a lot of good laughs.
No, it's definitely laughs. But it is kind of melodramatic. But pretty much everything with Samantha is fairly melodramatic. She's very upset for most of the movie. And it just, you know, again, sort of laying the groundwork for what would become or become his, Hughes's reputation.
The coming of age dramedy, to use one of your favorite terms.
Yeah.
Do you see any significance to the fact that her older sister's getting married other than it to serve the function of giving them something to remember instead of Samantha's birthday?
Well, it's just sort of more focus off of her, basically. I don't see much more than that.
Well, I just kind of saw it as, you know, it's a very adult thing to do. Like, getting married is kind of one of the most... It's like having a kid, buying a house, and getting married are, like, the adult things. And it seems like the parents pay attention to the little kids because, you know, they're kind of helpless and, you know, younger and need to be taken care of more. The older sister gets a lot of attention because she's doing this very, you know, adult rite of passage. And then Samantha's kind of just somewhere in between. She's not young enough to need all this help, but she's not old enough to be doing these adult things. And so it's kind of that awkward teenage stage where you're not a kid, but you're not an adult, and you kind of just get lost in the mix. Yep. So I thought that fit in pretty well for her sister to get married like that.
I agree.
Breakfast Club?
Yes.
The Breakfast Club? Next year?
Yeah, 85.
Written and directed by John Hughes?
Yes. Yeah, he wrote Breakfast Club before 16 Candles. And
oh, did he?
From what I've read, yes. Hmm. And I've read a book about it, so I assume that means it's been vetted.
Yes.
and researched and fact-checked. Yeah, and it was sort of like, I think both he and the studio were like, let's not give a first-time director a chance to do this movie that all takes place in one room. You know, I think Hughes was worried about that, and I'm sure the studio would have been as well, because... they don't go a lot of places in Breakfast Club.
No.
So
hallways.
Very, very contained.
Yeah.
That being said, I think Breakfast Club is a very pretty movie. Like, I like the cinematography in it a lot.
Yeah.
Particularly when they're in the halls and the very beginning when they're shooting sort of the shots that are like defining all these characters, like the jock shot, you know, like it's the gym and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I like the shots in general.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about Asian stereotypes in the last one. This is a very stereotype-heavy movie, just involving, and it's, you know, I don't think anyone was ever trying to hide that or would argue that. These are supposed to be very clear kind of touchstones for the different high school cliques that were around in the 80s, and I'm going to guess they're still around today, if slightly altered.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, the same general, well, I mean, I got out of high school, what, like 7 years ago, so I mean... I would imagine the same general things were still around because the same general things were around 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's been some sort of big revolutionary change in the world of high school outside of texting during class.
Culture accelerates, man. All right. So who are the five people in the Breakfast Club we got? Bender.
Yes. Judd Nelson.
Played by Judd Nelson?
Yes. He's sort of the badass of the group.
Yeah,
a variety of denims.
Leather gloves.
Yeah. And fingerless gloves, right?
Yeah.
They have to be fingerless. For added dexterity in his badassness.
In his ripping book pages out of books in the library.
Yeah. What's he going to need those for, man? and Ally Sheedy plays Allison, the sort of quiet, I don't know, what do you want to call her?
She's, I guess, just the weirdo. Like, yeah, as bad as it sounds, she's kind of the kooky...
Look, I love Cap'n Crunch. I'm not putting Cap'n Crunch on a sandwich. She's weird.
Yeah, I know. She's weird. I guess she's supposed to be the artistic, misunderstood one, although we don't really see her do that much artsy stuff.
No. It's just, yeah.
But she's kind of the quiet, introverted, weirdo outcast.
Yep.
Sorry, Allison.
I think she would be okay with that.
Claire.
Knowing her like I do. Claire, yeah. Played by Molly Ringwald.
Yep.
Sort of the rich girl, basically. Sort of the stuck-up rich kid.
Popular princess girl.
Yeah, popular princess.
Who skipped class to go to the mall and then thought her dad could get her out of detention. Mm. Yeah, I don't like her that much in this movie. Andy?
Andy, yes. Played by the incomparable Emilio Estevez.
Andy Bombay.
Exactly. I just watched this as young Gordon Bombay.
Who got into wrestling instead of hockey, but
it works.
Close.
It's a sport. It works. Especially since Bombay is such a dick at the beginning of the Mighty Ducks movies. You know, it's sort of like, he just went, sort of enforces the whole, well, maybe they go back to their old ways on Monday. But
cocky DUI lawyer. Yeah.
Blood, breath, or urine. No thanks, I'm full. Bombay.
So he's, he's just
the athlete.
The jock, athlete, alpha male kind of dude.
Yeah.
Despite being really short.
Yeah. He's a wrestler. He's got a low center of gravity. It helps.
That's true.
And then we've got Brian.
Brian the Brain.
Very subtle choice of naming for calling him Brian.
He arranged two letters.
Yeah. Can't even spell it with a Y to really make things a little.
And again, he plays our nerd.
Yes.
Our geek.
Yeah, the Brain character, if you will.
Yes. Again, not the typical geek appearance. This one, he is significantly less confident and funny than he is in 16 Candles, though.
Yes.
Yeah, he's kind of more shy and more apprehensive about speaking to strangers.
Well, yeah, because he's depressed.
Yes. Because he's suicidal.
Yeah.
That's the thing that makes people quiet down.
Yeah.
So I guess we should take maybe like 20 minutes to go over the plot of this movie.
Yeah. There's just so many things.
The synopsis is going to take a while.
The part where the library takes off and goes up and up to the moon, they just sort of have a lunch, some cheese on the moon.
Not much happens in this movie.
Nope. It's very conversation-based.
Okay. Not much happens physically. It's not what you would call an action-driven movie.
No.
It would be a character-driven movie.
Yeah. And that's cool. I enjoy it. That's fine.
Yeah. They're in detention. They have to write, I think it's like 1,000-word essay each.
Which ends up being about 150-word essay.
Between all five of them combined.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great. Yeah. And they're all in there for different reasons. And so they had the Breakfast Club they come in on a Saturday detention for, I think, 9 hours, which is pretty harsh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird that you can sort of make them come in on a weekend. I don't know.
From 7 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Yeah, bizarre. I don't know. Anyway.
Anyway.
The 80s.
They're stuck in detention. And, none of these people are really good friends. I guess Andy and Claire seem to know each other.
Yeah.
And care about one another.
It seems like, they're sitting next to each other. It seems like they would run in the same circles.
Yeah. The popular girl and the sporty guy. But yeah, I mean, most of these people don't really want to talk to each other. The principal. You want to talk about the principal?
Yeah. Played by Paul Gleason.
Yeah.
Principal Vernon. He's just sort of there to make sure they don't do anything.
Yeah. And he's a total dick. And reprises his role in Not Another Teen Movie.
Yes, he does. Awesome. Well, he played that type of character a lot. He showed up in Boy Meets World, like, playing that character. He showed up in Lizzie McGuire as well. A variety of things.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, the movie is basically them talking a little bit more and more and more until they're having very kind of, like, soul-revealing, very personal discussions about their depression or their lack of confidence or their abusive parents or being so popular in Claire's case.
Indeed.
Yeah. I saw someone call this a movie of a likable misfits. Is that appropriate?
Well, in that all teenagers are likable misfits, or misfits of some sort. Like, I don't know that you can call Claire a misfit.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Would you call her likable?
Nope. Okay. But, different people like different things,
I don't know how many people would really like her in this movie. Maybe some popular girls could relate to her, but I don't find her to be a very likable character.
No, because she's not.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I wasn't the only one. Basically, that really is the whole plot. I know I've said it, but they just kind of get closer and closer. By the end of it, they all befriend. They have a little discussion about, is everything going to go back to the way it was on Monday? Mm-hmm. They've really kind of bonded over the period of this day. But they worry that their social statuses might be in danger from communicating with one another in public.
Yeah.
And how's the movie end?
Like the very ending? Like they all sort of leave
the third act, I guess.
I don't know. I don't like. Well, they walk out together, and
yeah,
I mean, like they come in separately at the beginning of the day, and then at the end they walk out together.
Yeah,
and they all go their separate ways. And
yeah, Bender, who's kind of the, it seems to be the most selfish, self-centered person, you could argue, ends up kind of taking it for the team. And
oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
When he's running around the hallways for everybody when they get bored, he kind of sacrifices himself for everybody. Also gets like 9 weeks of additional detention,
right eight, off the eight bat. Of which were for his own his own ridiculousness.
Yeah, and we basically kind of one of the big reveals of the movie is learning how everybody got in there.
Yeah.
Gradually, I guess it is pretty important to the to their characters. Why is Bender in there?
I really don't remember.
Okay, Bender pulled a fire alarm.
Oh yeah, yeah,
which caused the school to evacuate.
Yeah,
and got 1 week, and then by saying. Got like eight more weeks, which seems a little uneven, but yeah. We'll deal with it. Claire,
it's the 80s, man.
Claire, as we said, skipped school.
Yeah.
To go shopping.
Of course she does.
Andy was
he taped Larry's buns together.
Yes. And then
I actually really like Amelia's speech, or sorry, Larry's speech. No, not Andy's speech about Larry having to explain that to his father. I think that's one of the more interesting parts of that movie.
Oh yeah, definitely. Mm. Some great Emilio acting as well.
Sure.
And yeah, his kind of whole issue is that it's his dad was a big jock in high school, and he just wants to be. He thinks he has to be just like his dad was. Mm. But kind of feels for the people he's victimized along the way. Brian, I guess Brian and Allison kind of tie for the. I wouldn't say tie, but they're near the bottom for the most depressing reasons to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. What is Allison's reason? I don't remember Allison's reason.
Allison's reason is she had nothing better to do on a Saturday.
Yes.
So she just comes to school and hangs out with detention kids and usually doesn't even say anything, it seems. Yeah. And yeah, Brian takes the cake, though.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I was like, how does she tie him? Like,
and what's Brian's story?
I don't totally remember. Like, he's just, he didn't get the grade that he wanted, or he almost failed shop, or he's going to fail shop, and he can't deal with that.
Well, he almost failed shop, and it was going to screw up his whole grade point average. So he brought a gun to school to try to kill himself. It ends up it was, unbeknownst to him, a flare gun, which went off in his locker. Mm. And you see the damage to his locker right at the start of the movie. And so he gets detention for that. Yeah, I mean, as we said, they all kind of grow closer together at the end, particularly Claire and Bender, it seems.
Yeah. The opposites attract, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, a little makeout sesh.
Yeah, a little makeout. Well, Andy and Allison make out as well at the end. And let's not forget Brian's epic makeout sesh with his essay.
Yeah, it's true, right? The other guy's get a girl to make out with.
Brian kisses his essay.
He gets left with the essay and kisses it.
Very upsetting. The most upsetting thing about the ending of this movie to me, Allison's makeover totally undermines everything about the movie. And I hate it. It makes me so upset.
I see. I've made this argument over makeover scenes and like almost everything.
Well, yeah, but I think this more than.
But this one in particular seems to be really like anti-intuitive. Right?
Yeah, no, it's terrible.
So what's the issue with?
Well, the whole point is like everybody should be okay with who they are, except you, Allison. You get a makeover to look like Claire, like. It's awful. And she even looks prettier without the makeover. Like,
do you think so?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm significantly more attracted to Ally Sheedy with her hair and her face than I am without.
Okay.
But it's so upsetting. And I remember reading this when Juno was coming out. I read Ellen Page talking about it. And she was so upset
about the
Ally Sheedy thing. Yeah.
Wow.
And because it's totally valid. And it undermines everything. And then just sort of... And that they're the two, the only two female characters in the movie sort of turn into the same thing, you know, like it's terrible. I hate it.
Yeah. Well, you know what, for the most part, I think I've made it clear that I do agree with you, but just for argument's sake, I guess you could say that maybe all the hair over her face and stuff, she was actually hiding herself.
Well, like, that's,
she was kind of ashamed of who she was. That's why she didn't talk and why she didn't really, present herself in a way that people would look at her a lot.
Well, Ally Sheedy says, she said that she wanted, like, they kept trying to take her hair out of her face, but she was like, no, because in high school I used to hide behind my own hair.
Yeah.
That's how I did it, and that's what Allison would do. And, yeah, I agree with that, but that, you know, still.
No, trust me.
That is, I recognize that you are making points that you don't truly believe, and I'm I don't have a comeback, but you're wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
It's upsetting.
So this is like the big one of the movies we're going to talk about. Probably Ferris Bueller is this close second, but as far as the most notable ones, the ones that really made these people stars, the ones that solidified John Hughes' place, you know, his talent and, you know, what we would come to know him for, this is the big one, right?
Yes. I would think most people, when they think of John Hughes, is the first movie they think of.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it, like, the teen movie? Like, is there a more quintessential teen movie even to this day? Because I know this is, I'd say, the teen movie of the 80s. Again, maybe Ferris Bueller.
No.
Yeah.
It's Breakfast Club.
Yeah. So I don't know necessarily what it is of the 90s and the 2000 to 2010s, but...
Mean Girls.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's cool. I like that one.
Yeah. It's a good movie.
But this, I would say this is more quintessentially a teen movie than Mean Girls is, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In that it set out, like, everything that would show up in Mean Girls. Like, when they're going around the cafeteria, pointing out the places where everybody sits, you know, like,
yeah.
that's the Breakfast Club, you know, that's the Breakfast Club's influence. It's that these groups have now been labeled, you know, like,
they're,
you know, there are groups in high school and the Breakfast Club explains them all. And then it also sort of explains that they're all people too, you know?
Yeah.
So that is the Breakfast Club's influence. The point, that sort of gets lost is that, the Breakfast Club explained that they are people, whereas teen movies, after it sort of just throw them into the labels and don't really flesh out any sort of character. Like, okay. I love teen movies. I'm not going to pretend that Bender is a less interesting character than Ethan Embry in Can't Hardly Wait. Like, there's nothing about Ethan Embry, despite that being one of my favorite movies, other than he's a writer who loves Kurt Vonnegut, and he really loves Amanda Beckett. That's it. And that's,
and he's funny.
Yeah.
And he wears t-shirts sometimes.
But yeah, no, there's just, and that I think is sort of the thing that John Hughes did that other teen movies don't do. And like I've said 1,000 times, I love teen movies, modern teen movies, but I don't take them and like with any sort of dramatic weight.
You know?
Like I don't care. Mean Girls is probably one of my 15 favorite movies. I don't take any of the characters seriously as people.
You know? Okay. Yeah. And when people, you know, spoof John Hughes, we try to, you know, just make a reference to him in like Family Guy or Simpsons or anything. It's pretty much always Breakfast Club, maybe Ferris Bueller's, but we'll talk about how that's kind of a John Hughes movie, kind of not. Yeah. But I mean, we see way more references to this than we do Pretty in Pink or 16 Candles.
Yeah, but Pretty in Pink is fairly influential. I think the level of influence is Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles.
Okay. That's fair. I know in 2005 at the MTV Movie Awards, they gave this one the Silver Bucket of Excellence.
Yeah. I just watched that last night. It was so weird.
Yeah. Did you see Anthony Michael Hall's joke about the other two?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. So not everyone was there. Emilio Estevez wasn't there for family commitments, and Judd Nelson was actually at the red carpet but didn't go up on stage for some reason. No one knows. But Anthony Michael Hall said, addressed that the other two were in Africa with Dave Chappelle. Because it was 2005.
That's funny.
And that's a joke you can make at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know how many other movies got the Silver Bucket of Excellence. I don't think a lot of them.
It doesn't matter. It's an MTV Movie Award.
I know, but...
It's important for The Breakfast Club, you know, like in that it was, you know, it's a super influential movie for the generation that grew up with MTV.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not just that this is one of the... best movies or most popular teen movies ever. It's that it's tied so closely in with MTV. I mean, John Hughes, we'll probably touch on this again, but the use of music is very important throughout his movies and his life from what I've read about him.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was the MTV generation. You know, a lot of times we see them identify themselves with certain bands or styles of music and things like that. And this really is the MTV generation that we get with The Breakfast Club. So I think it is, I mean, it's not as important as, I mean, no real movie awards are that important.
Yeah.
But I think it's more of a you know, a cultural touchstone.
Yeah, no, I agree.
These things came out at the same time and are still kind of intertwined.
Yeah, and Hughes movies are clearly very intertwined with music, always, because he has been attributed to sort of helping bring New Wave to the U.S. And you can see that in the movies, in that they all have sort of a... The music has sort of that British feel, and And like the music was such a big part of his movies that he ended up having, like, he got a record label out of the soundtracks of his movies. I think the Some Kind of Wonderful soundtrack was the only thing that ever came out on it, because, you know, but it was post Pretty in Pink that he got it. But he was very hands-on in the making of the music for the movie and the picking of the music, because it was just sort of like he was scoring these movies with his own tastes. And since that sort of came up with MTV and the music videos, and that music videos could so easily be packaged for these movies with clips of the movies.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like it's like an advertisement for the band and also an advertisement for the movie, and that intertwines the music and the movie even more. Like, you know, like Don't You Forget About Me is not a hit without The Breakfast Club. Like,
no.
Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
And there are a number of other smaller hits from the 80s that that are the same way. And, yeah, these movies were very intertwined. So, yes, I agree that it is it is somewhat significant that MTV would give them an award, because they should, because, you know, that movie and those movies in general helped MTV, and MTV helped those movies. You know, yeah. They're very much in concert the whole time.
Yeah. I do have some more things I do want to say about music later, but just one other point. I know, as you said, he had that record label, and yeah, I guess one of his he was offered a chance to put out the Ferris Bueller's Day Off soundtrack, and he said, like, it's just, he likes the music in that movie, but he doesn't think it would make a good soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And he's like, do you think kids really want Donkashen and Twist and Shout on an album right now?
Yeah. Although Twist and Shout after Ferris Bueller was re-released as a single and got on the top 40 again.
Really?
Yeah, which is the first and only time a Beatles song was re-released years later and hit the top 40 again.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No. That scene was huge, man.
Cool. Anything else in The Breakfast Club?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting movie, I got things to say.
Cool.
Oh, just a couple quick things. Okay. First, Emilio Estevez, sorry, Andy when he gets high, his dance sequence. I've seen people get high, you know, like I've seen people smoke weed before. I have never seen that reaction to marijuana in my life. Like, was that meth in there?
Yeah, what is that? Jesus. Not the typical, like, mellow out response.
Yeah.
It's going to punch dance around the armor.
That dance is so good, though.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And also, like, just some good stories about method acting, which I always get a kick out of.
Go for it.
Judd Nelson, big method actor, takes his work very seriously. And when he was... his audition was sort of like he came to the audition dressed like Bender, and he had to wait outside. And so he had this tennis ball, and he had his headphones on. He's listening to Sex Pistols really loud, and he's just throwing this ball against the wall really hard. And people are like, "Wow, that guy's really fierce. This is intense." And then he walks into the audition, throws his Walkman on the floor, still playing the music, and does his part, and then just like walks out. And yes. Like he was so intense, he would stay in character as Bender the whole time throughout the shoot, or he did at least at the beginning. Until, like, he was on the verge of being fired for being such an asshole to everybody.
That's awesome.
And, yeah, producers took him aside and were like, look, you're not this type of person. Like, he comes from a pretty wealthy background and stuff like that. You know, like, he's well-educated. And they're like, look, you're not this person. Be this person when the cameras roll. But don't be a terrible person when the cameras stop rolling.
Like, awesome.
Yeah. He was very close to being fired.
That's cool.
It's funny. I don't know that it's cool.
Smoke them up.
Yeah. The phrase, when you grow up, your heart dies.
Oh, right.
Ally Sheedy says this, or Allison says this at one point. And it's funny because I always thought the phrase was when you grow old, your heart dies. And I mean, very similar phrase, but means a totally different thing.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to grow up. And I think it sort of says a lot about John Hughes in that he never really did grow up. And that he was always sort of in touch with the teenage sensibility and always wanted to be in touch with the teenage sensibility. And one of the weirdest things I read about John Hughes in researching this is that during the shooting of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, he would call Ned Tannen's daughter, whose name was Sloane Tannen, would call her on the phone and talk to her for like hours. And she was like 16 or something. And yeah. And he would just call and, they didn't find anything weird about it because that's just sort of like, he was always very close with Ringwald and, Hall as well. You know, like they would hang out on the weekends and listen to records and all that stuff. Yeah. And it's just sort of like, he was always so interested in what the kids thought. And he would just listen to the Sloane Tannen girl talk for a long time. And, just wanted to know things. And she says he was always very tapped in and stuff like that. And he never, as you know, who post 80s, you know, nobody really knows all that much about him, but it seems like he never really grew up. His most well-known thing for shooting, like when they were shooting that scene where they're explaining all why they're in detention, John Hughes was lying on the ground, just under the camera, like with his hands on his, or with his chin on his hands, you know, like just watching them like a kid and sort of, you know, helping them with instructions and stuff like that. And yeah. And I think, I don't know, he got old and his heart did die. Like he had a heart attack, but what?
It's a very sensitive pun.
But he did, you know, if he didn't, who knows if he grew up, you know?
Yeah.
And that, I don't know, it's kind of a youthist way to look at things. Like, I think it's kind of healthy to grow up at some point, but
yeah,
it's just how you grow up, I suppose.
Well, yeah, and I hadn't even thought of this until you said it either, but the difference between when you grow up and your heart dies, when you grow old, your heart dies. I mean, you grow up when you're 17, you grow old when you're, what, like 60? Yeah. So he's saying that these characters are, you know, maybe just years away from their heart dying. You know, it's not just when you're old and decrepit. It's when, you know, just as you become an adult, you forget what it was like to be a kid or a teenager. So, yeah, it's a good point. I just never thought about that.
I guess the last thing, you know, I kind of want to talk about with The Breakfast Club is that Bender, I mean, I don't think you'll get much argument that Bender is the most interesting character in this movie. And I think it's sort of shown in that he is the last character we see in that final freeze frame with him and with his fist in the air. And I sort of see him as, and this isn't my idea, like I studied this movie in film class a few years ago, the beloved Barbara Bruce.
Wow.
Told this to me. And
he's surely listening.
Oh, look, if Barbara Bruce is listening, I would lose my shit. I would be so excited. But yeah, Bender as sort of like a trickster figure, like sort of this, like he's, you know, he's a human. He's not this totally mythical character, but he's sort of there to sort of turn things on their head. And that everything that happens in the movie is sort of because of Bender, like everybody getting to know each other is sort of Bender provoking them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he manipulates the whole day, you know, cause of everything that gets resolved because of Bender. And while he's still a person, but I mean, we see this sort of celebration, like, his fist in the air is sort of like a celebration that, yeah, I accomplished my goal. I got these people to see these things. Like I turned this day upside down, you know? And, it sort of can be applied again to John Hughes, in that, what John Hughes did with these characters, is that he made them feel real, but they're really not real characters. And in doing so, or sorry, they're not real people. They're real characters. They're not real people. But in doing so, he sort of defined all of the people that came afterwards in movies and to at least some extent in actual high schools. And it's sort of like John Hughes has said that parts of him are in all five characters, which is unsurprising given his background.
Yeah.
But I think he's very much, as the director of The Breakfast Club, he's very much Bender in that he sort of changes the way teens look at themselves. You know, he walks in this one day, everybody sees themselves as one way, and then Bender walks out, everything's totally changed. And this movie was a very iconic movie. It was very, changed a lot of things in teen cinema, changed a lot of things in cinema, period, and also in the way teens see each other. And I definitely see Bender as sort of a trickster figure and Bender as a stand-in for what John Hughes did with this movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like it.
And yeah. So, shall we move on?
Yeah, to my least favorite of this viewing experience.
Okay.
Luckily, I didn't have to watch, from the sounds of things, St. Elmo's Fire, which I may have hated more.
Yeah, look, anybody listening who has not seen St. Elmo's Fire, these things all happen in St. Elmo's Fire. The most awkward sex scene you have ever seen in your life between Andrew McCarthy and Ally Sheedy. They both hate being there. It's amazing.
Is it more romantic than the 8 Mile sex scene?
Significantly more so.
Okay.
No, it's, you know, it's just really bad. Rob Lowe does a lot of, sweaty rock saxophone soloing.
He's playing the sax.
Yeah. Oh, he's totally playing.
I thought it was just the soundtrack.
No, he's playing. He's playing in a band. Emilio Estevez also plays the creepiest stalker you've ever seen, who's somehow supposed to be endearing. They're all terrible people. Everybody in that movie is awful. Demi Moore tries to kill herself by freezing herself to death in her apartment.
What?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's also directed by Joel Schumacher, so there's that.
That I knew.
Anyways, let's move on. Pretty in Pink. I said my piece about Saint Helena.
Okay. So if everyone's watching this and is like, oh man, those were great 80s movies, let's go watch a ton of them, you would advise to skip Saint Elmo's Fire?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Saint Elmo's Fire is only interesting because it's the movie with the most Brat Pack members on screen at one time.
Right.
That's it.
Well, speaking of endearing stalkers...
Yeah.
Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
With Ducky.
Ducky.
Yeah, well, it's the plot of Pretty in Pink.
And that's the end of part one of our discussion of John Hughes and teen movies in the 80s. Be sure to check back next week for the conclusion.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Teen Movie Cheerleaders. Wait, there are guys who go to this school who don't play football? Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.